Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Joe Bagent died March 26 at age 65. If you've never heard of him, don't feel bad. You have lots of company. He wasn't the sort of writer or speaker that the corporate media care to publicize. In colloquial, profane, often funny, easy-to-understand language, he attacked the corruption of the system, the oppression by the capitalists and their corporations of everybody else, and the failure of democracy in America. And, almost unique among talented left-of-center people, he stood up for a neglected class, the class of poor white people, rednecks. There was no racism in this. He wrote what he was familiar with, and he was born and raised a redneck himself in West Virginia. This show is a celebration of and a memorial to Joe Bagent. I hope it will inspire you to check out his writing. One good place to start would be his website, joebagent.com. The last name is spelled B-A-G-E-A-N-T. www.joebagent.com. I can also recommend his 2008 book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. Here's a soundbite from Joe.
Because ignorance is the darkest kind of prison. You know, it's the one you can barely escape from. I did, but I mean, you know, it's the worst kind of prison of all. And because you don't know why these things are affecting you. But you know, your angst, your confusion, your darkness is somebody's tool. And that's the business of politics. We have to recognize that politics is to at least 50% dark side and getting darker, you know.
That was from a nice 2008 interview produced by American News Project. We'll hear the rest of the interview shortly. And on our show's website, you'll find a link to the video. Let's start with a nice obituary by Joe's friend, Fred Reed. Let me note that all the prose I'm reading today, I have condensed, edited, and in spots, censored for radio. Bagent moves on. We don't last, and there's no warranty. By Fred Reed. Joe lived a while down the lake. We would visit him, Vi and I, and find him, a bear of a man, writing on the porch of his one-room place in Ajijic, Mexico. Always he wore his old fishing vest. Usually we adjourned to the living room, which was also his bedroom, dining room, and salon. He would fetch bottles of local red, or make the jalapeno martinis he invented, and we would talk for hours. Sometimes he grabbed one of the guitars from the wall and sang blues, at which he was good. I guess growing up dirt poor in West Virginia puts that kind of music in you. Joe could fool you. He talked slow and southern, lacked pretensions, and you could talk to him for weeks without realizing how very damned smart he was. One day we dropped in, and he said he had just found he had cancer. It went fast. He died Saturday. Most who have heard of him have done so through his books, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, and Rainbow Pie, a Redneck Memoir. He tells of that huge class of unnoticed people in America, the white underclass of 1,000 small towns and countryscapes, including Winchester, Virginia, where he lived. America thinks it is a middle-class country. It isn't. Joe knew. You wouldn't see it at first as sociology. Joe is more like Mark Twain. Never eat cocktail weenies out of the urinal, he said, no matter how high the bedding gets. He talked of people working whole lives in jobs without benefits or retirement and generally getting screwed. He had no patience for smug commentators in Washington who were paid $500,000 a year and who talked of how America was a land of opportunity if only you worked hard. It isn't. He knew it. He lived largely coming out of the mountains and spending a year at the Corcoran School of Art, and drifting west, where his immense talent had him spending a lot of time with Hunter Thompson and the giants of the era, and writing for all manner of publications. He believed deeply in booze and recreational drugs, which in those years was perhaps not a view unique to him. He lived for years on an Indian reservation without electricity, worked as an editor for Military History magazine, likewise for an agribusiness magazine flogging pesticides. And he told horrendous stories of what we actually eat. He was miserable at military history, but needed to live. There was certainly a rural flavor to the man. Seeing a young woman with piercings in her nose and ears, and God knows where all, he commented that she seemed to have fallen face first into a tackle box. His politics may have confused the chattering classes. Joe was the least racist guy who ever lived, but he wrote about the white poor, whose very existence runs against hallowed doctrine. He was also explicitly in favor of the Second Amendment, noting that 90 pounds of dressed venison matters a whole lot to many families. These are families that book reviewers have never heard of. Joe described himself as a redneck socialist, and he was. He was profoundly concerned with the fate of the people he wrote about, those who worked hard all their lives and ended up with nothing. Funny, I've never met a socialist who didn't care about others, or a capitalist who did. It was great, brother. Hope to see you again in a few years. So ends Fred Reed's lovely obituary. Bagent moves on. Here's Joe, a few years ago, in his kitchen in Winchester. He's giving a guitar lesson to a friend. His song is called Woman, Love, and Automobile. You can see that his decision to become a writer, rather than a singer-songwriter, was a good career move.
Yeah, woman, I know what crazy about an automobile. Woman, I know what crazy about an automobile. And here I am, pulling up the road.
Let's hear some of Joe Bagent's stuff. Here's a section of his essay titled, If Memory Serves, Learning About Capitalism at Gunther's Garage. I read it on the show more than a year ago, and we'll hear it again now. Gunther's Garage is jammed between an unpainted shotgun shack and a weedy vacant lot on a skanky little side street in Winchester, Virginia. The place is really an illegal junkyard, but slips through the city code masquerading as a garage. Patronizing Gunther's is not for wallflowers, gays, feminists, or Yankees. You do not go there unless you don't mind being insulted. However, one thing Gunther will not do is cheat or overcharge you. Another thing he will not do is let a vehicle fail state inspection. As the owner of an ancient, rotted-out truck with bald tires, Gunther's got my business for life. Beyond all that, Gunther is of a vanishing breed. He's one of those crusty, homegrown experts who will expound on everything, from the vicissitudes of the stock market to America as an emerging police state. Last time I was there, Gunther was reared back in his one-armed swivel chair, behind a desk piled with 7-Eleven sandwich wrappers, rusted obsolete tools, and cigarette butts, holding forth on the stock market. I'll tell you what the stock market game is all about. I didn't remember asking, but I knew I wouldn't get my turn signals fixed unless I listened. Gunther continues. Used to be a guy would pick a stock based on the facts. After a while, it got so that people looked around to see what other people's average opinion was. And they bet on that. Nowadays, you look around and try to guess what the average opinion of the average opinion is. If you can guess enough other people's guesses about other people's guesses, then you bet on that and you make money. Don't bleeping matter if the stock is a dog. The stock market now runs the whole damned economy based on what fools believe other fools believe other fools believe. What if I ran my business that way? What if all I had to do was make people believe their cars was fixed? I'd go broke. You are broke, Gunther. That's beside the point. Studs Terkel once said that writers often portray working folks as having too much worldly wisdom, so I have always tried to avoid romanticizing such people for the sake of a good column. Still, the fact is that grizzled old tradesmen do get a good lick in now and then, and Gunther gets in more than most. Gunther has been a conservative all his life, though not necessarily a Republican. He admires Kentucky Senator Jim Bunning for being against the bailouts, which to Gunther and Bunning prove, "Socialism is alive and well in America." He says, "I bombed a bunch of Koreans so I would not have to live under communist socialism," thus proving Studs was right, that colorful working mooks are not necessarily the bearers of keen insight. Badgent continues, "Gunther might be a conservative, but there are a hell of a lot of people on the left who would agree with his opinion that them what cooked up this financial mess should damned well eat it." When Gunther and other members of the petty right posed the financial catastrophe in terms of the people versus the elite group who caused it, they are using the context of class struggle, whether they use that term or not. So does the Tea Party when it talks about Main Street versus Wall Street. Would that the Tea Partiers were as smart as Gunther. The petty right and the bumbling left find themselves unexpectedly meeting one another these days as they navigate the craters of our bombed-out economic landscape. Were it not for the ideological war in progress, they would probably form a powerful combined populist movement that would scare Washington right out of its silk shorts. Naturally, political strategists on both sides do everything possible to keep the rank and file from discovering the growing overlap of liberal and conservative thinking. Not many working people on either side still believe that what is good for Wall Street is good for Main Street, or that very much trickles down from Wall Street to our level. No matter how much money we sweat for or borrow, or Congress borrows in our name without asking us, no matter how much we throw at Wall Street, the money sticks up there on the 40th floor. Our market system of investment is based upon getting in at the right moment, grabbing other people's money, then getting out fast, which pretty much describes the key elements of a bank heist. Some people understood at the time that it was a banker-rigged game from top to bottom, one that included an elite cadre of players ranging from Wall Street to the Fed, the IMF, and the World Bank. Most saw only a few aspects of the global financial growth bot, but they saw them clearly enough to raise holy hell about it, and were clubbed down in places like Seattle and Miami. When it comes to truth versus the elite's muscle, there is no contest. In a show of elite muscle, some 3,500 cops were summoned to silence the 2010 Washington, D.C. truth-tellers. That is one cop for every three protesters at the anti-capitalist convergence. Total cost of policing, steel fence, and concrete barriers and precautions came to about $30 million, or $37,500 per protester. I had many friends at that protest, and I cannot think of one who would not have stayed home for half that amount. On New World Notes, we continue our commemoration of writer and social critic Joe Bagent, who died March 26. Let's hear some more of the interview we started with. The book they're referring to is Joe's Deer Hunting with Jesus.
We've all heard a lot about the white working class vote in this election. Joe Bagent has lived the life. He wrote the highly acclaimed book Deer Hunting with Jesus. We went to Winchester, Virginia, Joe's home, to talk to him about the vote in the upcoming election.
I mean, one of the arguments that you make in your book is that the Democratic Party lost the working class vote a long time ago. Tell me why, and tell me what you think it would take for the Democratic Party to get that vote back.
There were a time when good Democrats were down there on the line getting their nose broken with labor when it was on doing, you know, strikes and things, you know, back in another era. And they forgot about those people. At some point, the Democratic Party became the hobby of the Westchester Country Club.
But in your book, you say, you know, there's this guy, this character, Tom, and you say, no one talks to Americans like Tom about universal health care, universal education, paid parental leave, affordable housing, unemployment compensation, food stamps, or Head Start. These are shameful entitlements, more damn government giveaways, in Tom's opinion, frills. But wouldn't he want all those things, ultimately? Wouldn't he want those, and wouldn't he want to be a part of a political party that wanted those, too?
No.
Why?
Because they all sound like giveaways. You know, there's a, he certainly was a embodiment of this Scots-Irish white working class ethos. I don't need anything. I don't need anything for free. There's generations of the only thing you have is your pride. Don't take anything from anybody. I don't need any kind of help. Many of these people don't have an idea of a common good. Like Tocqueville said, he said, in America, no man owes another man anything, and likewise, no man owes him.
I mean, in this election, there isn't a lot of class analysis. And the moment that Obama even starts mentioning the middle class, he's accused of some kind of class warfare.
We won't discuss it because we don't even know it's going on. We accept that the health of Wall Street is the health of our family. It's not. In fact, it's usually the antithesis of it. You know, oh, our well-being is the well-being of Wall Street. That's not true at all. There's the money economy and the real economy. What is working class in America? We've denied that there was such a thing up until very, very recent times. But the fact of the matter is, if the man tells you when to go to work, when you'll get your break, when you'll get your lunch, how much you'll get paid, whether or not you'll get benefits, and when to take a walk when he doesn't need you, I'd say that's working class, and about 70% of Americans fall into that. It doesn't matter if you're wearing a technician's coat or anything else.
So why won't they blame the corporations? You talk about the Rubbermaid factory in the book a lot.
Because they can't see them and touch them.
Right.
You know, they're faceless, deathless things.
Well, what about the Rubbermaid factory in Winchester? I mean, you talk about that a lot, about how that factory basically has stayed, which is good, but it's also, over the years, clamped down on wages, clamped down on health care, and everything else that they can clamp down on, always threatening to move to Mexico or somewhere else if the workers don't suck up the pain. Why wouldn't the workers direct their anger at the Rubbermaid Corporation, and instead they directed at the government? I mean, the government's the boogeyman.
They can't demonize the corporations. I mean, what if you tried? Try to do something. Look around here. Is there anything that wasn't made by a corporation? Is my sustenance not delivered every day through a corporate-owned ATM? People, it is their environment. It is their consciousness. It's not just the advertisement. It's football. It's everything. These are all corporate propositions. And the constellations inside our mind, what we see, our mindscape, is a corporate landscape. It's a corporate matrix. There isn't any bad guy over there sitting there operating it from behind the scenes. It's the thing that we have accepted, that we've chosen.
So what do you think the folks who you write about in this book, how do you think they, or do you know how they've reacted to this bailout? Do they think it's a ripoff?
There's that discontent of rising anxiety. It's getting very, like, something's going on. It's like a siren in the room, but nobody knows its name. They don't know what to call it. They don't attribute it directly to that because they're used to seeing their money spent on things they don't even know what it is. You know, nobody batted an eye when they appropriated $800 billion to the Pentagon just shortly before that. You know, nobody noticed that, but no, I don't think that the word bailout wasn't the best name to give it. I'm surprised that the Spin Masters missed that one.
What's Joe's version of the American dream?
Fairness. Justice. The thing that's right, you know. Working people or philosophers all have that there. It just seems to be some kind of a internal scale. And if you can go to the most fundamental level of what is just, there's no man so brute and vile labor that he will not recognize that if you keep it fundamental and right enough. And I think for liberals, progressive liberals or whatever they are, you know, light, whatever they are, and that working man alike, you know, in the worst of conditions, that's the thing that's the same. And that's what Obama represents to liberals, at least the belief in it. You know, it's all rhetoric, but that doesn't mean that it isn't good. You know, struggle is for the consciousness of the planet, the consciousness of that smear of biology on a speck of cosmic dust. There's a spiritual side of man. There's a moral side. I'm not a Christian, but it's there, and it's there for us to share as a people together.
I'm gonna build a cabin 18 stories high. Then I can watch my doty girl when she goes traipsing by. I won't get drunk no more, boys. I won't get drunk no more. I won't get drunk no more, boys, and walk this old white road.
That's not my key to singing.
Now, a second selection from Joe Bagent's writing. This one also previously broadcast here, more than a year ago. It's a fine piece that shows shrewd insight. It's from a long essay titled Bass Boats and Queer Marriage. This selection talks about neither, but it does talk about how our government and our corporations behave as though they were run by psychopaths. As indeed they are. Bagent and I agree on this. Consider that, in the spring of 2011, the military is bombing civilians in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and now Libya. Consider that, in the wake of the Gulf disaster and now Fukushima, the government and the corporations are pushing for more offshore drilling and building more nuclear power plants. Well, don't get me started. In any case, recent events have only confirmed Bagent's insights. Let's hear what he has to say about our psychopathic ruling elites. Bass Boats and Queer Marriage. Both political parties keep assuring us that the great American middle-class lifestyle is not negotiable, then proceed to negotiate the hell out of it. Political assurances of the sanctity of the middle class come down to promising that the 6% of the world's population called Americans may continue to rip through 36% of the Earth's resources in its endless pursuit of obesity and carcinogenic intake. Not to mention taking everybody else out with us in the process, through ecocide. Nobody but an unmitigated psychopath would even make such a case, much less hawk it to the American people as being in their best interests. In their best interests to wipe out our dwindling planetary sustenance and to bleep off the rest of the world enough that a significant number are willing to strap on explosives and buy a plane ticket to the States. Unfortunately, the psychopaths are in charge, and they are charging all over the rest of us like rutting bull elephants on Jimson weed. There doesn't seem to be enough Thorazine on Earth to take them down. Consequently, their delusions have escalated to the point where they believe they are exempt from planetary catastrophe. But when the planet's condition gets bad enough, and that appears to be sometime next week, their children may not be exempt. This, of course, matters not a twit to a psycho, especially if the psycho is rich, powerful, and saluted by media networks wherever he or she goes, and has not the faintest clue that he or she is a psycho to begin with. The or she refers to Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, or any of the other power-crazed, warped-out bitches who have slit enough throats to make it into that gladiatorial arena inside the Beltway. White males by no means have a franchise on naked political bloodlust. America's constellation of psychos includes just about everybody with a few hundred million bucks behind their hallucinations, from Oprah Winfrey up to Ben Bernanke. Such people presume their anointment to rule. And why shouldn't they? They've experienced nothing but success through gaming the system and the rest of humanity, raping the proles in the ear and running the nation and its institutions for their own benefit as elites. Needless to say, they do not see things that way. To them, it's just the natural order of the universe. When you are urinating down on the world from the balcony of your suite on the 44th floor, it's hard to be humble or concerned about the pissant swarm on the streets below. Even if you're not the kind of psycho our political system attracts and legitimizes, it isn't easy. Our system, owing to the magic of its checks and balances, holds all possible solutions. So we must work within the system for any desired change. So the big shots advise us. Next, the big political players, Republican and Democrat, determine some minute variation on the most current lies being sold. These slight variations are proclaimed as profound differences between the parties, because both parties' role on the political stage is to play act as opponents. So cosmetic differences are netted out and then savagely contested in the theater state as life or death issues for the American people. If you have watched old mob movies, you know that any racket needs a front. In America, the front is called democracy. Like the term populism, the people have no idea what democracy really is, but they believe it has something to do with free market capitalism. So the people are given such narrow electoral choices as not to be even real choices, but packaged in somewhat different wrappers, such as skin color. Or, if a president and Congress can see a clear path in just rolling over the rabble are given no choice at all, such as going to war against Iraq.
I use the term rednecks. I embrace it. I am one, and it's the name of a culture, among other things. And I think that they are aware that something is terribly wrong. For instance, when we saw all those red-faced people screaming, went to one of those healthcare things recently, and three people were wearing guns. Of course, if you ask them, they would say, oh, it's my Second Amendment rights. But really, something much more ominous is going on. And the screaming and the hysteria and the unthought-out, irrational theatrics that we saw are the release of an incomprehension and an anger and an anxiety going on. You know, somebody just propped them up there and pressed their button because they don't have a language to describe where their problems are really coming from. But, yeah, everybody feels it. Everybody's afraid. Nobody talks about it. I think everybody in America senses that the ground has shifted under us, that nobody knows its name. Well, we know its name. You know, it's the collapse of capitalism as we've known it, American-style capitalism.
And I wonder, how long do you think we'll wallow in these false promises of recovery before something really important cracks open? Do you think you and I will live to see the Great Correction?
No. You know, I don't think so. You know, there is no recovery in the sense, you know, yeah, the housing market's going to come back like it was. We're all going to be doing the same thing, you know, as we did before. Obviously, it proved unsustainable. Obviously, it proved to be a bubble that when it broke, shattered everything around it. But given that people, this is the only consciousness they have. This is the only world they've known, the one that they were raised in a corporate state. Personally, I know he wouldn't get reelected, but I would much have preferred to see Obama stand up, name it the way it really is, and at least, I know a lot of urban liberals and super conservatives especially wouldn't buy it, or they wouldn't want to buy it, but we all know what the truth is. Common sense tells us what's sustainable. I would rather he be noble and right than in bed with the snakes he's with.
Ending our memorial in his own words, we heard Joe Bagent, interviewed in 2009 by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, www.ecoshock.org. Thanks to all. You'll find links to everything on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. Illicit to my non-carborundum. Rest in peace, Joe, and see you later.